Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, the 2015 Kids Count Report is out, providing the latest data on children's health and well-being in the first state.
When we're making decisions, that we understand that it's based in what's really happening out there, because those things are going to have long-term consequences for our kids.
We take an in-depth look at the 20th annual edition of the report. In the late 1800s, railroad companies enticed Americans to travel by sending landscape artists into the wild to document the country.
You just needed to get people emotionally involved in getting out there and expanding. So landscape has never been just about pretty pictures. It's also about communicating the country and what's important.
We meet a Delaware painter aiming to shine a light on the first state's agricultural history. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine the battle between hunters and a group of school kids over the gray fox, and chat with Autism Delaware's executive director as Autism Awareness Month begins. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this week, the 2015 Kids Count in Delaware Factbook was released, offering the latest snapshot of information on the well-being of children in the first state. It's the 20th annual edition of Kids Count, which tracks data in a variety of areas involving kids, ranging from infant mortality to dropout and graduation rates to the number of kids living in poverty. The idea is to provide the kind of information that can help policymakers and others develop plans to address these issues and then help track how well they're working. Joining us on The Green this week is Janice Barlow, director of Kids Count in Delaware at the Center for Community Research and Service at the University of Delaware, to talk to us a little bit more about the report. Janice, thank you so much for joining us this week on The Green.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first off, before we delve into this year's report, it's 20 years of Kids Count reports here in Delaware. And I wanted to ask you at this juncture how you feel it's lived up to its mission of not only tracking this data, but helping inform policy and assess the effectiveness of those policies.
Well, I'm probably a little biased on that, but I think we're doing a great job. Kids Count has really worked throughout the 20 years to get the message out to policymakers and advocates and people in the nonprofit and the public sectors who create programs for kids and their families. And we're seeing the data being used by a variety of people, especially with the change in our society to electronic communications. We're getting it out to more people than ever before. So I think that we're doing well on that. But of course, we always are looking for how can we get this to be used by more people and for it to go further.
And to that point, what do you feel like you guys have learned over the years, and maybe what has changed in what you're doing to make it more effective and provide that information either better or, as you mentioned, to more people?
Well, one of the things that we've decided to do is we've stopped printing our full version of the book. It's now up to more than 250 pages, and it's really cost prohibitive. So we've changed to a digitized format, and the book is available on dekidscount.org, and it's free for anyone to go on and download. It is in a digitized version, as I said, which it kind of looks like an online magazine where you can flip through pages and you can, there are internal links, there are external links, so we refer people out to other data. In addition to that, we have a listserv that we push out data through. We are active on social media, Facebook and Twitter, those types of things. So all of these emerging technologies give us just a little bit different ways to reach different groups of people.
Is there more depth to the information now than there was 20 years ago?
Absolutely. 20 years ago, we were reporting on 10 indicators of child well-being. Now, we still report on those original 10 indicators, but now our book has more than 100. And every year, we have a data committee who looks at the book, who looks at the data we report, and who look at what's going on in the big wide world and give us recommendations for where we should make additions, what else we might be able to get our hands on in order to make that picture better every year.
Is there a fine line between giving more data and at some point having too much data, that swamping people in data?
Right. Data overload is definitely a worry. And it kind of goes to the accessibility issue. If you give people too much information, it reminds me of the old Census Bureau reports of data and data and data and data, just table upon table and just numbers, it overwhelms. And so one of the ways we try to combat that just a little bit is we try to be very visual. We bring in lots of graphs and charts and maps so that it's a little less intimidating, it's a little less overwhelming. In all of our publications, we feature photographs of Delaware kids so that it's inviting so people can look at the kids and realize that, you know, these aren't just numbers we're talking about. There's a face behind each of these data points.
Let's talk a little bit about this year's report. And there's a number of areas where we see improvement for kids in the first state. And one that I recall being maybe one of the more major sources of concern years ago was the number of teens having kids. How much has that improved? And is there a sense of why the needle has maybe moved in that area?
Actually, as you said, this was our 20th year edition, so we looked back at 20 years. So we took the data from 1995, and we're comparing it to what we have today. And as you said, teen birth has been a dramatic improvement. We have fewer births, we have fewer teens having babies. Back in 1995, it was 33.5 per 1,000 girls. It's dropped almost in half, 16.2 per 1,000 girls in the most recent data year. As for your second question on why that's happening, there are a number of theories out there, and researchers haven't, you know, kind of landed on one consensus. Some of the theories out there are better access to contraception. Other people think it has more to do with the economy. There are a number of prevailing theories, but no one single leading factor that we can point to with certainty.
At the same time, low birth weight babies and infant mortality remain concerns in Delaware, correct?
Absolutely. In Delaware, infant mortality and low birth weight birth in particular, remains very high above the national average. In the national narrative of things, the nation started improving, and Delaware, for some reason, did not. We were still struggling while the nation was making these improvements. There's a lot of work going on around this issue, a number of partners coming together in order to try to improve things. And in the most recent years, the past 2 to 3 years, we've been seeing very, very small incremental improvements in our Delaware data. So it's a hopeful sign because, you know, this is a big issue. And so it takes a lot of people, it takes a lot of resources, it takes a lot of focus in order to move that needle just a little bit, but we're seeing it move.
Back on the plus side, the report also shows a big drop in the dropout rate and increases in graduation rates. How big are those gains when you look at it over that 20-year period?
Back in 1995, the number of teens who were not in school and not graduated, so that high school dropout, was 4.6, and it's now at 2.1. So again, practically in half.
And I guess that we've also seen some movement on the other side of that same equation, the graduation rates going up.
Yes, correct.
Are there still within those numbers some areas for concern when you break it down to different minority groups, those with disabilities, those type of factors? Are there still some areas, as you dig deeper into those numbers, where there's still some room for improvement in that educational area?
There are inequities. When we look at the data, we see disparities by race, by income. In education in particular, with the testing data, we see big disparities by income, not as much by race. When we look at dropouts and the graduation rates, we see disparities by both racial and ethnic, as well as income. We see disparities as well in students with disabilities. So yes, there are other concerns when we break down and we go a little bit deeper into the data.
And is that why it's important really to track this data and dig deeply into it? Because maybe that top line data might give you one impression, but as you dig deeper, there are other things that need to be looked at?
Absolutely, yes.
One of the other numbers that jump out, and I guess it's kind of tied to what you mentioned in terms of the economic disparity in education, is the percentage of kids living in poverty, which is, it looks like, nearly doubled in 20 years. What are we seeing there? And does that type of number have the potential to undermine some of the more positive trends we're seeing?
Yeah, poverty is very concerning because it is connected to so many, every other indicator we report. A child doesn't kind of live in a vacuum. So if a child is in poverty, then obviously they're going to have fewer material resources. But then it can also impact their health, their safety, their education. So in particular, children who live in concentrated poverty, areas of 30% or more where of the community in poverty, they have increased safety concerns. There may be environmental hazards, for instance, that could inflame asthma. And if a child is sick or chronically sick, then they're staying home from school more than their peers. And if they're not in school, they're not learning. We also know that children who grow up in poverty in the very early years tend to begin kindergarten behind their more affluent peers. So poverty does really affect everything else.
And beyond poverty, what are some of the other things you're looking at in terms of that family environment and economic sphere?
We're looking at family structure, whether we had already talked about birth to teens, but then other types of family structure. Are children being born to single parents? Are they being raised by single parents? Because that has a good influence on whether or not they will be in poverty. These days, it's just really, really hard to get by on a single income, especially for low-income single mothers who are working or don't have the education beyond a high school diploma. The job market is such that it's difficult to find a livable wage job, a job where a single mother with a high school diploma can support an entire family.
As we wrap up, when you guys put this out each year, and maybe even more specifically this year, what are some of the things you're hoping will be done with the information? And is there hope that more can be done now because you have 20 years worth of information for people to look at and kind of make those comparisons that we've been talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that we hope that happens every year is that it brings an awareness that when we're making decisions, especially when those decisions have to do with policy, priorities, and programming, that we understand that it's based in data and it's based in what's really happening out there, because those things are going to have long-term consequences for our kids and, you know, kids that haven't been born yet but will be our kids in the recent, you know, in the soon-to-be future. This year in particular, because we are very concerned about the child poverty measure, we looked at best practices within this kind of area, and what we've been educating people on is the earned income tax credit, which is it's a safety net piece that's built into our tax structure where working low-income families can receive funds back at the end of the year at tax time. And research has shown that linking the EITC, an enhanced EITC, to increases in minimum wage is pretty much best practice for reducing child poverty. The EITC has been linked to better infant and maternal health, better school performance, and college enrollment for the children in the families who've taken the credit. And in Delaware in particular, our earned income tax credit is based on the federal credit, but ours is non-refundable. And so what we think is that if we enhance that, if we make it refundable, it will help more of our children who are in poverty to get out of that.
All right. Janice Barlow, Director of Kids Count in Delaware. Thank you so much for joining us on The Green this week. We appreciate your time and insight.
Thank you.
The full Kids Count report, as Janice mentioned earlier, is available online at dekidscount.org. Up next, our political reporter, James Dawson, looks at the battle between hunters and a group of school children over the state's wildlife official animal, the gray fox. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green, and I'm Tom Byrne. Hell hath no fury like a fourth grader scorned. A class of elementary school students at the McVeigh Elementary School in Newark was behind a 2010 law dubbing the gray fox as Delaware's official wildlife animal. Now, just a few years later, lawmakers in Dover are trying to allow state environmental officials to create rules and regulations regarding the hunting and trapping of that same animal. In response, a new crop of fourth graders has taken up the gray fox cause, protesting that move. Delaware Public Media's political reporter James Dawson tells us more.
If you walk into Paul Sedaka's classroom, you might hear this. Maps and educational posters adorn the wall here like most classrooms, but this classroom may be one of the few with a flowchart outlining the legislative process on a whiteboard. Sedaka's class of eager kids has been following House Bill 25 since it appeared earlier this year. The proposed legislation would allow the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control to draw up regulations to control any hunting or trapping of the gray fox. The fourth graders unanimously oppose the legislation, and they're taking it personally. Governor Jack Markell signed the bill naming the gray fox the state wildlife animal at McVeigh Elementary in front of the student body back in 2010 after students there pushed for that designation. The animal isn't endangered, though, and there is precedent for states harvesting official symbols, including in Delaware. Several states list the white-tailed deer as their state animal, which is ubiquitously hunted throughout the country. Fishermen use Delaware's official marine animal, the horseshoe crab, as bait, and anglers are also allowed to hook the weakfish, the first fish of Delaware. Supporters say the bill is needed to help alleviate issues with those who accidentally shoot or trap a gray fox when they were aiming for a red fox, which is legal under Delaware law.
What's happening now is people don't want to get in trouble by it, so what they're doing, they're basically shooting, shoveling, shutting up. You know, they're not telling us, you know, and if we could get some numbers, then we would know.
That's Representative Dave Wilson, who sponsored the bill. He says these regulations would also allow DENREC to take an accurate count of the animal within Delaware's borders. One of the bill's staunchest opponents, Representative John Kawako, offered up two amendments during the House debate that would have nixed an open season on the animal and the fur trade clause, but both of those failed. Kawako and others say the bill shouldn't allow for hunting or pelt trade provisions if the goal is ultimately to take care of nuisance animals.
When you want to deliberately construct a human attack on something in nature, then have a better reason than just to say, oh, we need this because we need it, or we need it to take account, or we need it because an industry needs it to make more profit.
The bill now waits for a Senate committee hearing. Two amendments similar to Kawako's are attached to the bill, and that's where Sedaka is hoping the bill dies.
Our goal is to have the bill stop in the Senate. If it somehow passes the Senate, our next deal will be to go to Dover and let the governor know that if he's going to sign the bill, he's going to have to deal with us.
Governor Markell says he will sign the bill as it currently stands. McVeigh student Ben Garrett says that seems odd to him.
I think he's just insulting himself. Like, why would you do that? You signed the bill to make the gray fox the state animal. You're signing this bill to hunt the gray fox? Just, I don't get it.
But the students are open to some compromise. The bill also allows poultry farmers to kill the animal without a permit if it's directly attacking their chickens. Kids in the class mostly agreed with that provision, but some, like Cassidy Foskett, suggest there are other choices farmers can make.
They can run out there and they can, like, clap their hands and jump around, and that'd probably scare it away because it's a really shy animal.
Sedaka says this civics lesson has been different from the one he taught 5 years ago, but it's just as valuable. Regardless of the outcome, he says he has further plans for his students.
Let's protect this animal. Furthermore, let's take it, let's double down, my friends. How about this? If they want to build a shopping center and there's a forest that has a population of gray foxes, there should be a study done on the impact of the gray foxes there if they build a shopping center.
A similar bill introduced in 2014 would have instituted similar hunting and trapping framework as House Bill 25, but the Senate amended those aspects out last year. That proposal never reached the House for final approval. Should this bill pass, Sadaka says he's prepared to bring the children to Dover to protest with parental permission. James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks to our political reporter James Dawson for that piece. Stay with us. There's more coming on The Green, including a conversation with Autism Delaware's executive director as Autism Awareness Month gets underway. But first, the latest news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. During the month of April, autism advocates hope to draw the public's attention to the needs of people and families affected by this complex disorder of brain development. On Thursday, Governor Jack Markell signed a proclamation at Legislative Hall in Dover, officially recognizing National Autism Awareness Month in the first state. Earlier in the day, Markell was the keynote speaker at the United Nations for World Autism Awareness Day. He joined UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in urging businesses to make concrete commitments to employing people with autism. Increasing autism awareness is considered a key aspect in the effort to fund research that will better equip health professionals. To learn more, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter recently spoke with Autism Delaware's executive director, Teresa Avery.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that one in every 68 people in the U.S. has some form of autism. And Teresa, the first state is not immune to that trend in rising numbers.
Absolutely, Kathy. And in Delaware, we've seen the same kind of rise. In fact, in 1991, there were 152 children in our public schools with an educational classification of autism. Today, there are 1,512. That is an 895% increase over 23 years.
Teresa, would this be, it could probably be a combination, actually, of maybe more cases reported because of awareness, or are we seeing more actual cases of people having autism?
You know, that is a question of some debate across the country and around the world, Kathy. But, I mean, certainly we are better at seeing autism today than we were even 10 years ago. I don't think there's any debate on that fact. But depending on what study you look at, people have different feelings about whether there's an actual rise in autism. When I look at the statistics, that incredible rise says to me that something is going on here. Yes, we're better at seeing it, but I really think there's something beyond that as well.
And why is that, Teresa?
Well, again, that is something that researchers around the world are working really hard to find out or to try to get some idea on. We have clues. I mean, there are tantalizing clues as to what might cause autism. But no one has the answer. And that's one of the scary things about autism is I always say there are a lot of no's in the world of autism. There's no known cause for autism. There's no medical test to detect autism. We can't prick your finger and say, oh, yes, we've seen a blood test, you have autism. It's done by behavioral observation. And, of course, there's no known cure for autism. So it's a tough thing.
It is tough. And folks like you, Autism Delaware, your mission is to help people and families affected by autism. How do you do that, Teresa?
Well, we offer a wide range of services. Those include advocacy at both the state and local level. We provide a lot of family support, so we have parent mentoring. We have a new parent packet that includes all sorts of resources, including the names of service providers from throughout the state so parents can find them. We have support groups. Last year, we had 197 different social recreational activities around the state. We also work really hard to connect people to resources in the community. We do not try to provide everything that a family affected by autism could need. Instead, we try to know what's going on and where the resources are so that we can tell families, hey, you know, call Family Voices, call Family Shade, call the Parent Information Center. Here are the things that they provide. Call Easter Seals. Here's what they provide. This is a community effort. Autism Delaware also provides clinical services, including parent-child interaction therapy. And we're actually nationally known for our community-based adult vocational program called POWER. And through POWER, we have participants with autism spectrum disorder who are working in individual businesses throughout the state of Delaware.
You mentioned vocation, and on World Autism Awareness Day Thursday, our governor, Jack Markell, will be one of the keynote speakers at the UN to mark World Autism Awareness Day. He's actually speaking about making a commitment to employ people on the autism spectrum.
Yes, absolutely. Governor Markell has been a national leader in the field of vocational awareness for individuals with disabilities, and we're so proud that our governor has been part of that effort, a big part of that effort. So we're just so thankful to all the legislators and the governor who are supportive of individuals and families with autism across the lifespan, and that includes employment for individuals who are adults and need to be out in the work world in the community.
What are potential employers missing out on if they don't consider hiring people affected by autism?
Well, people with autism spectrum disorder are each unique. We say in the community, if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism, because they're each individual people, just like anybody else, and each of them, their autism affects them differently. So people with autism can and are wonderful employees. They find a job they love and are good at. They can be wonderful at any of a number of things. What POWER does, our adult vocational program, is provide job coaches and support. So we come in and work with employers and say, what is it that you need? What are you looking for? And then we work with our participants and we get to know their skills and what they like to do, what they're good at, what they want to do. And we match those things together so that the employer is getting someone who wants to be there and wants to do the job. They're getting a job coach who's going to help support that person towards success. And they're getting somebody who really is going to do a great job on the job. So what we find with our employers is that often it does start with a wonderful impulse of altruism, wanting to do something great for someone else, and certainly we applaud that. But it often ends up with, hey, we got a great employee. And over time, what's wonderful to see is the fact that the participant has autism fades away. And the participant becomes not the participant, but just John or Steve, a member of the team, just like every other employee. And that's really what it's all about, integrating individuals with autism into our communities, into our workforces, because all of us will have fuller, richer experiences in life if we're all included.
Sure, and speaking of vocational training and being part of a community and families, all of the family, I imagine, is affected when one person in the family has autism. It can be an economic hardship as well.
Yeah, autism, unfortunately, is very costly for the families. From an economic perspective, from a time perspective, from an emotional perspective, there is a greater number, when you look at families of children and then adult children with autism spectrum disorder, what you'll find is a larger number of two-parent families where one parent has had to make the choice to stay home and thereby forego that second income that most American families do have. Then there is the cost of therapies, certainly not all of which are paid for by insurance. Positive steps have been made in that direction, but families often have to go out of pocket to pay for the therapies that they need for their children. So it can be a very, very daunting prospect when you have a child diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder.
There are some community resources, of course. Actually, last December, the Brandywine Center for Autism opened in Wilmington.
Yeah, absolutely. We're really excited to be working with the Brandywine Center. In fact, Marcus Henry, who started that effort, is on our board of directors, so we're really thrilled to be working with them. And there are therapists available throughout the state, including the Brandywine Center, to offer things like ABA therapy. The important thing is for families to look at what it is that their family needs and then reach out to look at what providers are available and who can work best with them to meet their needs.
And Teresa, finally, sometimes we fear what we don't know. So there's a bit of a stigma still attached to people with autism. What do you want to tell people who have a little bit of fear about interacting with people on the autism spectrum?
The important thing to remember about interacting with folks on the autism spectrum is that, frankly, they're human beings just like you and just like me and just like everyone listening to the sound of our voices right now. There's nothing to be afraid of. Get to know them as people, and you'll see that there's really no need for a stigma attached to autism. People with autism are each unique, each individuals, and again, I really believe that our lives are fuller and richer, every one of us, when we take the chance to get to know each other and include everyone in our communities.
Our thanks to Autism Delaware's Executive Director, Teresa Avery, for joining us this week. The annual Walk for Autism will take place at Cape Henlopen State Park in Lewis on April 18th and Fox Point State Park in Wilmington on April 25th. For more information on those events, you can visit dellautism.org. Next on The Green, the northern long-eared bat is officially becoming a threatened species. Science reporter Eli Chen talks to a DSU researcher who specializes in bats to learn why and what it means. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Next month, the northern long-eared bat will officially gain status as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. The decline of this bat species has largely been due to the spread of a disease known as white nose syndrome. To learn more about the impact of this disease on the northern long-eared bat and other bats in the fur state, Delaware Public Media's science reporter Eli Chen checked in with a Delaware State University researcher whose work centers on bats and their behavior.
Officials estimate that white nose syndrome has killed from 5.7 to 6.7 million bats in the eastern United States. The disease, which causes a white fungus to sprout through the bat's muzzle, was first found in 2006 in Albany, New York. It's likely that it was brought over from Europe via cave divers. 3 years ago, DENREC announced that officials detected white nose syndrome at Fort Delaware State Park. DSU bat scientist Kavina Volnick says bats affected by the white nose syndrome fungus end up getting uncomfortable like a person would with athlete's foot. But the fungus bothers bats so much that they fly out at odd times when there's no food around and end up starving to death.
It causes the bats to rouse during hibernation, and they rouse a lot more than they normally would. And because of that, they're not able to eat. So the bats up in New York and stuff, if they rouse and they fly out of the cave, there's no insects out there.
At her laboratory, she and her researchers study white nose syndrome by using scanning electron microscopes to see how the fungus looks inside the bat's body. Volnick says long-eared bats tend to return to the same place year after year. That could be one of the reasons why the disease has such a great impact on that species.
They're philopatric, so they like to come back to the same place. If it happens that the fungus is in that place, they'll just be reinfecting themselves.
Another bat on the state's threatened species list is the little brown bat, which tend to roost in caves. Caves provide cold, damp environments that allow the white nose syndrome fungus to thrive. If a person sees a bat in Delaware, they're more likely to come across the big brown and red bats. The long-eared species have a lower presence in Delaware, but they're still listed on the state's threatened species list. Volnick says now that the long-eared bat has been placed on the threatened species list, researchers like her may pay even closer attention to the species.
We might target that bat and try to find out more about them. Where are they roosting? Where are they going? And when you're working with an endangered species, you've got to be very careful, especially a federal one. You have to, you know, get the proper paperwork. The important things are, what are the ways we can keep them alive?
Bats have a lot of value. They are critical in pollinating many major crops, and they help get rid of pests for farmers. A 2011 study in the journal Science estimated that declining bat populations could cost the agriculture industry $3.7 billion annually. There are ways for homeowners to help encourage bat populations. Volnick suggests building something called the Bat Box.
It's a commercially made box, or you could make your own, but it's a wooden box that's set up, has baffles inside, and it's perfect for bats to live in. So it's a roost for the bats, and you can put them up on a pole outside of your house. You have to have certain requirements. It has to be facing the sun in a certain direction. It can't be too close to trees. It can't have a certain, you know, there's a lot of criteria that you have to look for. Or you can buy them commercially, and you put them around your yard, put them on your house, and that will really encourage the bats to come to your yard and maybe eat up all your insects.
The long-eared bat will officially receive federal protection on May 1st. A public comment period is open until July 1st. Eli Chen, Delaware Public Media.
Our thanks to Delaware Public Media's science reporter Eli Chen and Delaware State University's Kavina Volnick for their insight in that piece. The Green continues in a moment with this week's edition of Enlighten Me, which highlights a project that connects agriculture and art. Stay with us. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. The history of some of Delaware's oldest agricultural farms and families is being preserved in paintings. The Delaware Century Farm Portraits Project will feature oil paintings of the first state's oldest century farms, agricultural properties that have been owned by the same family and farmed continuously for more than 100 years. Through interviews with these farming families, the project will tell the stories of how these Delawareans sustained and advanced their agricultural heritage through generations. In this week's Enlightened Me, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter rejoins us, talking with landscape painter Mark Reeve of Milford about this intersection of art and agriculture.
Artist Mark Reeve is partnering with the Delaware Department of Agriculture. You're on a one-year-long project to preserve the images of historic First State farms. It sounds like a fascinating project. Mark, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you for having me, Kathy.
How did this all get started?
Well, I've been an artist for most of my life, and certainly in Delaware, I've been a landscape artist for about 18 years. So I've been looking for ways recently to be able to connect my art with some of the greater concerns in the state economically and community-wise. Agriculture, you know, being a landscape artist, you see how much of a part of the identity of the state that is and how much it drives the economy. It's a big part of what Delaware is. So I brought this project to the Department of Agriculture in the winter of 2013 and said, hey, you know, how can we celebrate sustained agriculture and do it artistically, inspire people for the next generation? And we came up with the idea of let's do a series of paintings of the oldest century farms. Those are the farms that have been in the same family and agriculturally operated for more than 100 years.
Mark, you say telling these stories visually and literally through people's lives can tell us so much about our society.
That's true. Just seeing how much heroic effort it took to bring farms from generation to generation through centuries, we really do kind of see the story of America. There's many times when economic depression was an issue, many times when the certain challenges of farming in general were an issue to just make it viable for the next generation. So farmers had to rethink, retool, had to look at the economy as it was at the time and be able to find ways to be relevant for those times. And a lot of times it meant changing their minds about what they did to be more current, to be modern.
A great example of adapting would be the Woodside Farm Creamery in Hokesson.
Absolutely. Woodside Farm was a dairy for many, many years, of course. Certainly dairies have gone in decline over the past several decades. So they looked at what they had and wanted to build on their core, and they made a destination. And that's a very big trend right now in agriculture. Agritourism is a huge part of economic building for agricultural concerns. So that was a great way for them to retool. And certainly the creamery is a fantastic location. People go there and then the ice cream's great and they have other products. And it's very much connected to who they are and what their identity is. But it's something that brings people in.
Do you see some of that in other areas of the state now taking a lead from Woodside Creamery?
Oh, very much so. There are more dairies that are becoming ice cream locations and destinations. Agritourism in general is becoming a trend as far as farm to table. Farmers are meeting up with restaurants and becoming food kind of connected as far as the tourist side of things. So that's farm freshness is also important. And so people are changing what kind of crops they're growing to be able to service the markets in the local area and bring fresh produce. So it's a far cry from being soybeans and corn only, which basically fed the poultry industry and the livestock industry. They're thinking in terms of other aspects of agriculture and how it can serve the public.
But there is still a lot of opportunity for agriculture in this state in the sense of economic development beyond agritourism.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that's happening in this Central Delaware, especially through the Economic Development Office, is seeking out ways to create food hubs in Delaware and basically attracting more food processing. That used to be a huge part of the state's agricultural mix. Usually when the things were grown here, we packaged them up, canned them, and sent them out. Of course, global economies, things changed. The railroads came in. Transit was made more easy between East and West Coast. So, you know, that trend, I think, is starting to reverse in that that local produce aspect. People want to have things as fresh as possible from their local areas, local growing areas. So that's a trend that's definitely in place now.
So the Delaware Century Farms Project will feature approximately 10 paintings you'll be working on. How is it going for you?
It's going very well. It's a lot more work than I imagined, of course, but the paintings are looking good. I'm feeling very confident about them. I got I have seven of them that are completely done at this point. The three last ones are in progress, so that's pretty good for keeping ahead of the curve schedule-wise. And May 1st to June 30th is when the exhibition is running at the Delaware Agricultural Museum and Village. There'll be a special reception on May 14th to kind of play up the exhibit. I also have some presentations from the Department of Ag, hopefully, and from our sponsor, M&T Bank, who's a primary presenting sponsor. And they'll be talking about some of the financing options that are available to agriculture operations now. We also wanted to talk about the Young Farmers Program, which is something the Department of Agriculture started a couple of years ago as a low-interest loan possibility for people getting into the industry. One of the things that has been interesting about this whole project is that in the process of making the paintings, I had to actually interview the farm owners and talk about their property, talk about the history, talk about how they made it go from generation to generation. And one of the things that's kind of a point they keep calling up is it's hard to get into this business. It takes a lot of money to start up an agricultural operation for the tools, the land. You have to have enough land to be able to grow enough to be able to make enough money to get the profit back from your investment. So the Young Farmers Program is a way of helping people with those costs and not be so burdened by the initial startup. So that's one of the things we wanted to talk about as well, inspiring the next generation to get into agriculture. Another aspect that was interesting in those interviews is how wide a scope agriculture has now as far as professional choices. It's not just, you know, farming, planting, harvesting, and selling. You have the science side of things. GrowMark FS, who's one of our sponsors, kind of has that side of the story. Farming encompasses marketing, it encompasses engineering, science, it encompasses a lot of different aspects. And of course, we just talked about the agricultural tourism side, so it really does deal with, you know, bringing visitors to Delaware.
What a fascinating and unique way to tell these stories through art, and what a partnership.
Yeah. Art is a unique communication. There's no doubt about that. And that's one of the things that really inspired me to start this project. When you talk about just taking a picture of a farmer in front of their property, you know, it's one thing. It's very direct. It's very honest. But when you do a painting of it, it's an interpretation. And there's a certain amount of emotion that can go into that that's not being seen by the camera's lens. And that's been the fun thing about doing these paintings. I mean, I've done portraits in the past, but I hadn't had the chance to do it in a long time. So it was really nice to be able to focus in on people's character and who they are, and just from the photographs that I was using as source material. It was inspiring. You know, you really get to delve into people's eyes and look into their souls and see what they really feel about what their property means to them. And that's an important part of all of this, is that you didn't keep a farm in the same family for generations and centuries because you didn't care. As a personal investment, it's something that's meaningful emotionally to them. It's part of their identity and part of their fiber. And it's really interesting to see, again, how they inspire their children and grandchildren to go on with the mission. And some families, how they don't know how that's going to transfer to the next generation. So there's that challenge from generation to generation to get the children of those families to say, hey, this is something that's important to me as an individual as much as it is a business concern.
Speaking of challenges, what are your challenges as an artist in this particular project? Anything that you haven't come across before as a working artist that was unique to this project?
The portraiture aspect was certainly something that I ignored for a long time, so that's been good getting back into it. It's been a very intense exposure to it. You have 10 different paintings with some of them being double portraits, so it was fun to be able to really work that up a lot more. Time has been the biggest issue. I don't think there's enough time in the day to be able to really get things done sometimes, but it's certainly working out, and it's been an interesting time management study for me as well, to see how much I can accomplish in a certain amount of time. The other side of it is, again, going beyond the photographic lens. That's a big challenge with any artist. You're not just recording, you know, photorealistically something. You're actually trying to reinterpret, to inspire, to communicate. And historically, landscape has been a great communication device. Certainly in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when railroads were trying to entice people to go out into the wilds, you know, you had marvelous landscape painters like Thomas Moran and Frederick Church and some of the others that just brought back these glorious visions of the wild. You know, never mind the fact that you had the life-threatening dangers that were out there as well. you just needed to get people emotionally involved in getting out there and expanding. So landscape has never been just about pretty pictures. It's also about communicating the country and what's important.
Our thanks to artist Mark Reeve for enlightening us this week. The Delaware Century Farm Portraits Project will be on view at the Delaware Agricultural Museum and Village in Dover beginning on May 1st. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. A reminder, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our newly revamped website. If you have comments on this week's show or story ideas for future shows, contact us via our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, Eli Chen, James Dawson, and Carl Malgiro, as well as our station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks so much for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.